From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, we'll take a look at the life and science of Benjamin Franklin. We all know about the famous electric kite experiment, but Ben Franklin did much more than fly a kite on a stormy night. He was a philosopher, a politician, a statesman, a printer. He was an inventor of bifocals, the Franklin stove. He is even credited with converting the colonies to a paper currency. Franklin was also a well-known scientist in his day. He was celebrated around the world for his insights into the nature of electricity, and his image appeared on all sorts of pottery and on medallions. So, on this 4th of July, what better time to take a look at the life of scientist Ben Franklin? Joining me to do that is Dudley Hirschbach. He is the Baird Research Professor of Science at Harvard University. He is Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1986. That was several years after he was invited to try out for the Los Angeles Rams. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Hirschbach.
I'm happy to. It was really many years after the Rams.
What position?
I would have been a wide receiver in the modern lingo.
Interesting, interesting. So you have at least one thing in common with Franklin, in that you're both accomplished athletes.
Yeah, many people don't know that Franklin's the only founding father in an athletic Hall of Fame.
Huh, which one?
Swimming.
Oh, no, I mean, which Hall of Fame? I mean,
the Swimming Hall of Fame.
The Swimming Hall of Fame.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a wonderful explanation of this by Claude Ann Lopez. She has a great book, My Life with Benjamin Franklin, published by Yale University Press in 2000. And she describes how over the 25 years she worked with the Franklin papers, she became entwined with Ben in so many ways. And she, in particular, researched the story of his swimming prowess, which was very considerable.
I want to remind our listeners that they're welcome to join us with their questions or comments about Benjamin Franklin. Our telephone number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And as I remember, Dr. Hirschbach, that Ben Franklin invented a tool for swimming faster.
Yeah, what we call spin flippers. He also had sort of paddles on his hand. He also described with glee how he discovered he could use a kite to pull him across the water. So he had early experience with kites. I know later in the program we'll be talking about his famous electrical kite experiment.
Okay, well, we do have that coming up. But these are sort of, you know, these are sort of nifty, gadgety kinds of things. But he was really a scientist, as not just a tinkerer. Is that right?
That's right. He really contributed markedly intellectually to formulating the ideas, the key ideas that led to understanding electricity. When he began, he became intrigued with it by seeing demonstrations of an itinerant lecturer. We didn't have TV back then, of course, so or radio, so there were a lot of lectures that go around and intrigue people with demonstrations and all, and that's what he first saw on a visit to Boston, and later he began his own experiments and became fascinated with them. In fact, he retired at age of 42, in part to concentrate on those experiments. He said he never became so obsessed with anything else in his life.
Was being a scientist in the mid-18th century, 1750s, was that something that gentlemen could do? They didn't need a national lab with a synchrotron or an accelerator or something like that?
Yeah, it was a totally different thing. In fact, no one spoke of a scientist. The word was natural philosopher. The word scientist, as we use it now, really is a very late usage, not until the 20th century, in fact. It really used the way we do it. Now, science meant then, the word science existed, but it was meant a systematic body of knowledge organized in some way. That's why we still have words like political science.
I see. Okay. And, you know, one of the things that I didn't realize until I started researching for this program is that one of the things that Ben Franklin got interested in was lead poisoning. Can
right.
you tell us about that?
Yeah, he wrote a letter at age 80 in which he reflected on 60 years of observations that convinced him lead was a very toxic, dangerous thing. My favorite of many examples he listed was one in which he described how suddenly a whole family became afflicted with what was referred to as dry bellyache. And he pointed out that years before, the family had planted trees around their elegant house. The trees had grown up over the years to such a height that leaves would be shed on the roof, and roofs of such elegant houses had lead joints. And then the rain would cause the leaves to decay and emit acids that corroded, you knew some chemistry, corroded the lead. And that ran off into the cistern that collected drinking water, which was a customary way of getting your drinking water right off your roof. And so he pointed out that that's why it happened all of a sudden. Once the trees reached this height, the family was going to be poisoned with lead. And he had many other examples, but as a chemist, that particular one struck me. And he lamented at the end of this letter, which would have been written, 1786.
86, right.
He lamented that things may long be known before they are properly appreciated and acted on. And it was 200 years before we passed laws dealing with lead poisoning and paint and gasoline and all.
Interesting. Well, let's invite our listeners to join in this conversation. Let's go to Barbara in Minden, Nevada. Barbara, welcome to Talk of the Nation Science Friday.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I've read several biographies. One was called First American about Franklin, and I had never realized what a genius he really was, and how much ahead of the time he was. Unlike Jefferson and other founders of our country, he really was self-educated. He came from which was unbelievable, that a man who had very little formal education and who at the age of 14 had to leave home would emerge as such not only a scientific genius but a political genius, a man who was just really ahead of his time, centuries ahead of his time. And I was just wondering, he also, of course, discovered tides, I believe. I also want to ask the professor if he felt that today, in today's political scene, where money seems to control those who make it to the top and are successful rather than ability, intelligence, and experience, whether he felt a Franklin could have emerged as such a positive force in our nation's history.
Yeah, of course, it's uneasy even to think about such a question today, because we all know what goes into these huge political campaigns, and whether someone like Franklin could rise to play the kind of role he did in the 18th century, you have to say it's, I'm afraid, doubtful. On the other hand, Franklin was so resourceful. If he were somehow reincarnated, you couldn't rule it out by any means.
But didn't he make some money in his life?
Oh, he made money. In fact, he retired after only 25 years after he arrived in Philadelphia as a runaway, 17 years old. As I mentioned already, he retired at 42. But he wasn't concerned about money primarily. I mean, as he said, it's only a question what good you do in your life. And as the recent biographies, there are two that just appeared within the last year, one this week by Walter Isaacson and one last fall by Edmund Morgan, are both excellent, and the year or two before that, one by H.D. Brand. And of course, you may have seen the public television program last November on Franklin.
Yes, yes.
All those things show how incredibly resourceful and versatile he was. He, as you emphasize, he had only 2 years of schooling, and after age 10, he was apprenticed first to his father, who made soap and candles, and then to his half-brother James, who turned him into a printer, but also treated him very badly. So it's uncanny what he did on his own.
Barbara, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Emmett in Denver. Emmett, welcome to Science Friday. What's your question?
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. Couldn't think of a better person to be listening to you on the radio about than Ben Franklin. He's my favorite of all the founding fathers, for sure. I think he embodies everything that Americans are, innovative, humorous, a little brash sometimes. And as you're describing his career, I'm thinking that he probably encountered more resistance than maybe any of the founding fathers, just for who he was and what he represented. I was curious if he had a mentor or a coach or any people in his life that he turned to for guidance when he was making all these amazing decisions and discoveries and commentaries on the State of the Union back then.
Well, he, in his autobiography, attributes books he read as a youth to sort of forming his general attitude and his determination that he wanted to contribute in a useful way. You know, he was born into a family in which his father was very, very pious, and in fact, it had immigrated to the United States to avoid religious persecution, and belonged to a sect in which it was not a question of whether you earned salvation. It was just something that happened automatically if you observed the right rituals and happened to be chosen.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But Franklin, on his own, decided that was not something he was going to accept. And he mentions Pilgrim's Progress, and then Essays to Do Good by Cotton Mather that convinced him of the sort of approach to life he wanted to take.
Interesting. I'm curious now, though, Dr. Hirschbach, why did you become interested in Benjamin Franklin?
Well, it happened a long time ago when I was a graduate student, and I was present at a special symposium celebrating his 250th anniversary and Mozart's 200, which happened to coincide nearly, and there was a performance on the musical instrument Franklin invented, the glass harmonica, for which Mozart had composed, and also a string quartet attributed to Franklin, in which he specified that the four instruments were tuned in a way that each played four different notes. And then the string quartet used only open strings. So you saw the players who used to go in like mad with their left hand, had nothing to do with their left hand because they played only open strings. And, you know, it just gave me a glimpse of a side of Franklin that intrigued me. And so I began to look more and more into this guy. And over the years, I learned a lot about his science and all the rest. But he has so many dimensions.
Yes. No, he's clearly, I guess you'd call him a polymath because of his range and depth, huh?
That's right, you know, for sure. He was just incredibly curious. And as Morgan emphasizes particularly well in his recent biography, he also was very selfless. I mean, he worked very hard on all these political things he was involved in over decades. But again and again, when he saw that the way he was based on his rational analysis, the way he was convinced was the best way to go, wasn't going to work, he would compromise for the sake of getting something better than what had existed. That was a very attitude. And he always very happy that other people would get credit. He tried to bring other people into all of his projects, as he describes over and over again, particularly, for example, in launching the hospital in Philadelphia. He described how effectively that approach worked. He felt that you could do much more if you weren't perceived as someone who was trying to get credit for doing good. Instead, you should get other people involved, so they all got credit.
Okay, well, I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Well, we're talking to Nobel laureate Dr. Dudley Hirschbach, who's taken a personal interest in the life and career of Benjamin Franklin, and we'd be happy to have you join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to caller Al in New Jersey. Thanks for calling, and what's your question?
Hello. I can't help but be amazed at how much the man did in his lifetime, so I have to wonder, did he sleep?
Well, everybody sleeps, I think. Maybe the question is, did he sleep much?
Okay, if you will.
Okay.
Well, he had very firm ideas on sleeping. He wanted you to throw the windows wide and let air in and so on, no matter what the weather was outside. There's a famous story in which he and John Adams had to share a bed one night. And Adams describes how Franklin insisted that he throw all the windows open and so forth.
Interesting.
So, he did sleep, but he had a pretty organized life. And in his later life, he slept fairly late in his 70s during his time in France, because he realized the importance of all these evening affairs in influencing the ladies, who influence the intellectuals and powers, political powers at court. And it had something to do with why he was so doggone amazingly effective in getting the French to contribute money and troops to aid the revolution, which, you know, seemed a pretty, that's a pretty amazing thing, because it was not at all obvious the colonies could succeed in defeating the greatest military power there ever existed, and a power that had been beating France over and over again in wars for 20 years. And France was, of course, very uneasy about supporting the colonies in rebellion, because if they lost out, France no doubt would have to give up still more territories to England, as they already had, and so forth. So Franklin was amazing. He slept, but he clearly was, he made excellent use of his time, and he talks about that in his autobiography.
Al, thanks so much for the call. What about, I mean, do you think that that making excellent use of your time is a hallmark of a great scientist?
Well,
mm-hmm. I
don't know you necessarily say that. I mean, obviously, if someone, a scientist or not, does something great, you would say, yeah, they did excellent use of their time. But, you know, you can't tell in the case of science whether what you go into is going to turn out to be something everybody says, oh, that's excellent use of your time. Because chances are, if it's going to turn out to be something extremely valuable and important, you can't really tell at the outset. And it's a sort of leap of faith or intuition or whatever. And very often the story is that some scientists are later seen to be ahead of their time or to have recognized opportunities that others... But if they don't pan out, you don't hear that story. So,
all right. Well, we'll be talking more of this about this, but right now we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Ben Franklin, and with my guest, Dudley Hirschbach. Now, let me bring in my next guest. Tom Tucker is a science writer and the author of Bolt of Fate, Benjamin Franklin and His Electric Kite Hoax, just out by Public Affairs Books. He joins us by phone from North Carolina. Thanks for taking time out of your 4th of July to join us.
Hi, Joe. Glad to be here.
And I'd like to remind everybody that they're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. So, a provocative title, but maybe we should step back a little bit before we get to the kite experiment and talk a little bit about what people knew about electricity before Franklin began his experiments.
Well, in 1746, electricity had become the rage of parlor science. It became a fashion. In fact, it put the French dancing masters out of business in London, they said. So it was this marvelous moment in history when science really threw a party. And on the one hand, you had serious thinkers, and on the other hand, you had celebrities, royalty, and beautiful women. It was quite a scene.
So it's not electricity like we think of today, where they weren't plugging stuff into wall outlets. What did electricity, what did that mean in the 18th century?
What they were working with is static electricity. In other words, it's the same charge we get on a dry winter day when you walk across a carpet and reach for a doorknob and you get snapped, or when you rub a cat's fur and get a snap. At this time, they were producing these snaps by friction, and they had devised some really elaborate little devices that were used in fashionable parlors to get nice sparks.
Huh. I wonder whether the phrase sparks went off between them comes from this time when people were actually making electrical parlor games and kissing was part of it.
Interesting question. My book has a whole chapter about sex and electricity, and they really did sort of merge for a while during 1746, and as much with Franklin as anybody else. In fact, spark was a sexual term in that time, and it was used in the servant class for someone wanting to go off with a liaison with a lover. She might ask her mistress, "May I go off tonight, Mom, for a little spark?"
Interesting.
So but up on the high end, the mistress might be in an experiment in her parlor looking for a spark, too.
So what was Benjamin Franklin trying to show with his kite experiment?
Whether he did it or not, this is an experiment which is meant to demonstrate that lightning and electricity are one and the same. Franklin wasn't the first to have this idea. Many people in the time had suggested it, but certainly the electric kite was an experiment which was intended, in any event, to demonstrate that that was the case.
And what part of the experiment do you think is a hoax?
Well, really, I need to back off a little bit.
Okay.
It's part of a story, but what I noticed when I first looked at this, if you start looking at the authentic 18th century sources behind this story, they're just not there. Things start to unravel. First of all, Franklin never actually said he did it. In his original announcement, he simply said it might have been done. Secondly, it's just not characteristic of the way he worked. Nor was science reported in that way in this era. There's no hour, no month, no day, no witnesses. 14 years later, he said there was a witness, his illegitimate son, William. Typically, Franklin would do these experiments and teach them to his disciples. He didn't do that in this case. Typically, his disciples repeated them in public. None of his disciples repeated them in public. Instead, abroad on the continent, in London, people were doing variations in the year afterwards on Franklin's lightning experiment with lots of modifications for safety and to make sure it wasn't foiled by moisture. But in Philadelphia, there was a virtual silence. And I don't think it actually happened. I think the scenario is different. It goes back to 1746 when Franklin first started making brilliant discoveries and trying to report them to the Royal Society at London. His first report went there to William Watson, who turned out to be a rival, but who stood up, read one of Ben's experiments, and said that he had thought it up a year earlier. There's no documentation for Watson's claim. It's highly unlikely he did. Franklin, however, continued to send reports. His second report was even more brilliant. It explained the Leyden jar in terms of his plus and minus theory of electricity.
I guess we're going to have to come back to what a Leyden jar is, or maybe you can just give us a sense of it quickly.
Well, it's an early version of the conductor. It was a way of really getting a bigger charge. And Franklin came up with a brilliant explanation of the phenomena, and his report on it just vanished at the Royal Society. So he was stonewalled there for 4 to 5 years. After a time, he began to send joke insults across the Atlantic to William Watson. For instance, one of these was an experiment in which you electrified a portrait of King George. Attached to his head was a crown, which was held there by electrical charge, and Franklin proposed a game in which the participants tried to remove the crown from the king's head. Franklin called the game the conspiracy. Of course, that could get you hanged in that time. But if Watson said he'd done the first experiment first, the question really was asked across the ocean, did you do this one first too? This led to lightning. About a year afterwards, and after some insulting notes sent back to Franklin privately by Watson, Franklin sent a suggestion across the Atlantic that he stand beneath a 40-foot metal pole in a field during a thunderstorm to prove that lightning and electricity were one. At the end of the suggestion, he said, you know, sometimes people are blinded by lightning strike. Was Watson meant to do this experiment? I don't think so. Watson never touched it with a 10-foot pole, nor did Franklin, nor did anybody else in England. But a couple years later, in France, two novices in electricity who had poor English translation skills set up the experiment at the urging of someone at court who wanted to embarrass a rival in electricity, and they performed it. It was done in Marly, France, a small village outside Paris. As soon as these men had finished the experiment, they went back to Versailles, and Franklin became an overnight celebrity. They glorified his name.
Because they proved what he predicted.
That's right.
That there was that this electricity in lightning was the same as this electricity that people had been playing with in the parlor games.
Right. This was demonstrated, or close to demonstrated. We didn't go into all the details, but it was certainly convincing and awe-inspiring to people in the era. And Franklin was given full credit at the French court. The king sent his compliments, and it was called the Philadelphia Experiment. Right. Of course, the question then was, when are you going to do the Philadelphia Experiment in Philadelphia? And my guess is, at this point, and it fits in terms of shipping and message times, at this time, Franklin dreamed up the idea, oh, I flew the electric kite. I did it 4 months earlier, but I just didn't mention it to anybody. And he announced it in his local newspaper.
Okay, well, I want to stop you just for a second and see if Dudley Hirschbach, this issue about whether the kite experiment was real or not has come up in the past. Do you feel that this argument is persuasive, or do you still think the experiment was done?
I think it was done. I would like to say at the outset that I don't think anybody can prove in an absolute way that it was done or wasn't done. And by the time you reach page 223 of Tom's book, which incidentally I enjoyed very much, I got only a week ago, and
by the way,
it reads wonderfully. It's an exciting, dramatic presentation and all. But by the time you reach page 253, Tom says, well, there is no proof. So you agree, I think, judging from what you said on that note on page 253, that nobody can really prove it. So you have a case of circumstantial evidence, and you have to look at a lot of evidence. And for a while, Tom, I was wondering when I got well into the book if you were going to announce that you were pulling a hoax here. You do point out that the great expert on Franklin's hoaxes, Max Hall, doesn't agree with you that Franklin would have made a hoax of this kind, and I think we can get into details why I can't agree either, but a lot of it has to do with the overall picture of what Franklin did in science. I would just emphasize one point that you mentioned at the outset, that Franklin didn't say he really did it, and it sounded different, you thought, than the way experiments were announced in that era. But I don't agree with. If you read what he said in the famous letter where he first announces it, he sends a letter to Peter Collinson, who was the guy he corresponded with primarily in announcing his electrical experiments. He said, may be agreeable to the curious to be informed that the same experiment, referring to this Philadelphia experiment, has succeeded in Philadelphia, though made in a different and more easy manner, which is follows. And then he describes how to make a kite and so forth. But if you look back at the very first letters in which he sent his main key results in his electrical studies, it's the same thing. He describes conclusions, and then he lists experiments. For example, Tom will recognize what's called Letter 3, which is way back in September of 1747.
Dr. Hirschbach, I need to interrupt just briefly.
He says it the same way.
I need to interrupt just briefly to tell people that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I have a feeling that we can argue a lot about this, and in fact, people who like Ben Franklin will argue a lot about it, because it won't have a satisfying answer ever. So you can nobody can be proven right or wrong at the end of the day. Tom, would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I would say that Dudley and I probably are not all that far apart ultimately in how we view the experiment. I think I'm a little different in having written a book that focused so intensely on it and so many aspects of it. And when you do that, also you begin to look at Franklin's character, and it becomes, and I don't mean my book is a debunking. I have the greatest admiration for him. And really, I'm saying that I think it's a hoax that ultimately determined the course of the American Revolution, perhaps, and that we owe a great debt to Benjamin and also to his kite for what he did.
Interesting. Let's invite a caller to join this discussion. Roland in West Los Angeles, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. I always had questions regarding the kite experiment because of the... I couldn't see how twine or string conduct electricity. And I was also wondering about... what effect this had on the American Revolution, as the guest just spoke about.
Okay, Tom. And maybe, Tom, but you should just quickly, and we only have a few minutes left, but can you quickly describe the kite experiment involved putting up a kite and then attaching a brass key to it by an insulating silk thread? Is that right?
Right. Here was the experiment. His kite twine was packing thread, and that did conduct electricity. It was probably hemp, and it was a conductor, and if it's hemp is a bit moistened, it conducts even a little better. And what he did was this. He sent a kite up above that atop had a 1 foot or more metal rod on top that was pointed. Franklin had a theory that a metal point would attract electrostatic charges, and what he hoped to do was attract something from the stuff that was in the clouds, electrostatics above, to the point, the metal point on top of the kite. It would go down through the twine, down to the bottom where he had a metal key attached, and he separated himself from this metal key by a silk ribbon. Silk was a non-conductor. So you had this charge that had come down the twine. It did not continue on to the earth. And what he did then, he could have, for instance, brought his knuckle next to the key and received a snap, just as would have happened in a parlor with an electrical friction generator.
So the theory is right, but whether the experiment happened or not is something we could have several shows about. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this show, so I'm going to have to stop the discussion there. Thanks to all of our callers who joined us this hour, and I'd also like to thank my guests. Tom Tucker is a science writer and the author of Bolt of Fate, Benjamin Franklin and His Electric Kite Hoax, just out by Public Affairs Books. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Nobel laureate Dudley Hirschbach is Baird Research Professor of Science at Harvard University and a failed tryout for the Los Angeles Rams. Thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Well, I was glad to. I hope Tom and I can talk about this again sometime.
Okay, well, I hope so. And earlier this hour, we spoke to Stephen McKnight, chairman of the biochemistry department at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineers in New York are Thom Moorman and Paul Masiello. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. You can also email us with your comments about this show. Our internet address is scifry@npr.org, or surf over on the internet and visit our website at www.sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.